Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to What Makes You Tick. And I have a fantastic guest today. This lady I met a year or so ago and was super impressed with not only herself, but her fantastic husband, Raina Maycock. Welcome to What Makes You Tick.
Thank you for having me.
Raina, the reason I thought it would be important for you to be on the podcast is the work that you're doing on protecting children, right? And you were the founder of CHIRP, which is this fantastic technology that's been created for parents to protect their kids from grooming, cyberbullying, and so on. I'd love you to talk about that and just kind of give people a bit of a sense of what CHIRP is and why you decided to find this business. Where did the idea come from, and what's the story?
It's a bit random. I'm a non-tech founder of a tech company. I started my career off in radio sales, selling people advertising. And now here I am. I had a conversation with someone yesterday, our new board member, actually. And she was saying, you know, why did you do this? And it's been so hard. And I was like, if I had known how hard it was going to be, in retrospect, I probably wouldn't have done it. But hey ho, I won't moan about it. We're delighted to be where we are. So I started off in radio sales, ended up going into TV, had a variety of different management positions, ended up being chief executive of a group of radio stations. And that was when I was 30, and then went and left there and started my own business, a matchmaking company with my husband called Intro, which still goes strong. It's Ireland's biggest matchmaking agency. He'd kill me if I didn't give it a plug. And then about 8 years ago, around the time I was having my kids, so I've got a 9 and 10 year old now. And it was around the time I was having my kids. And, you know, you'll know this, your perspective changes entirely. And all of a sudden, all I could see were headlines of kids that had been systematically cyberbullied, groomed, sextorted from, coerced and pushed into suicide. And I was thinking, surely technology is dealing with this problem. You know, the one common thread in those stories, Stephen, was that parents didn't know there was a problem until it was far too late. You know, you read these stories and parents are just, I didn't know. And so I took a deep dive into the parental control market to see what tools were available to parents, particularly when they gave their child a smartphone. And the state of the art back then is very similar to the state of the art by right now, 8 years later, and that's parental control apps. There's about 250 parental control apps on the app stores, and they all share a variety of features. They have access restriction and monitoring to stop your child becoming addicted to their phone. They've got pornography and gambling website blocking, geofencing and geo-tracking so you can find your child. But none of them are dealing with cyberbullying and grooming. And I was thinking, surely I'm not the only parent that's concerned about this. And I remember looking at a Webwise study that was done by the Irish government at the time, and it was to assess parents' main concerns when they gave their child a smartphone, and they had four main equal concerns. So parents were worried their child would access pornography, spend too much time online, be groomed or be cyberbullied. So the pornography and the access restriction were being super served by the parental control apps, but the other 50% of parents' needs were not being met at all. And as I said, I'm a salesperson at heart, that's my trade. So with my salesperson's hat on, I was thinking, there's a clear market fit here. Why is nobody filling this gap for parents? So I started to dig around and speak to some technologists, some professors in computer science to try and figure out why no one was doing it, and realized very quickly no one's doing it because it's hard. Okay. And so not to get into the weeds too much on the technology of it, but you can download all of the best in show of parental control apps to your child's device, but they sit at the same permissions layer as Snapchat, TikTok, WhatsApp, Discord, which is where cyberbullying and grooming happens. So no app technology can ever deal with cyberbullying and grooming because an app cannot gain access to another app. So the earliest point in the tech stack that you can access all incoming and outgoing data, and it's really important to be able to access specifically encrypted apps because they're very dangerous places for kids, that is the kernel level, which means that you rely upon a smartphone manufacturer to embed your technology at point of manufacture. So you effectively, you hand over your autonomy to a point. Your business model is different. So the parental control apps had autonomy. They could spend $500,000 developing an MVP, launch it to the market, use the revenue direct from parents to, you know, incrementally improve their technology, but the technology at that point is limited. So our model has to be B2B because we license to telcos, we rely upon smartphone manufacturers, and the telcos have the power of the smartphone manufacturers. But that means that our route to scale is much faster. I mean, direct to consumer is really slow, B2B is really fast, and our product is very sticky once we get out into the market. So no one was doing it. Getting back to the point, no one was doing it because it's hard. So all of the advice at the time was, for the love of God, don't do it. And we just ignored all that and we decided to pursue it anyway. So, look.
And was that advice there in place because it was hard?
Yeah.
Not necessarily because it was the wrong. It was the right thing to do, but people just didn't want to invest the time and the effort and the stress and all that stuff into it. Is that why you were getting pushed back?
That's why we were getting pushed back. Okay. It's, you know, the reliance upon a smartphone manufacturer. You know, you'll have... We, in the end, once we scale, we might have 20 big customers in the world, but they'll be massive customers. Mm-hmm. And just nobody had come up with the technology. It's very, very disruptive.
It's so surprising, though, that nobody had come up with the technology, isn't it? Because, yeah. Like, how quick businesses are. Like, I remember when apps first became the zeitgeist, everybody wanted an app. Mm. But now that you're going to the... as you said to me before, the kernel mm-hmm. of the software, like embedded in it. Is there a fear that your software will upset their handsets? Or is it a case of there's so many regulations and compliance and all these things to get through and hoops to jump through that it's just you're banging down doors or banging against walls because people are just not necessarily, they feel that they can put their time into something else that'll be quicker wins.
Yes, that's true. Particularly from a funding perspective. You know, it's easy to fund B2B SaaS enterprise software that, you know, completes a need and yeah. it's a very obvious return investment for big corporates, yeah. And this was what we were talking about was at the time, looking at ways to try. At the time, we were thinking, do we need to break encryption? Is that what we need to do? We didn't know. And there was this reluctance to invest in or get involved in anything that might end up being a zero, right? So if I heard you'll be hero or zero, once I heard it a million times, mm-hmm. Everyone was saying either you're going to be the best thing since sliced bread and you will achieve your mission of being the global parental control, the machine standard parental control available on all computing devices, or you'll waste our money and we'll lose everything. And the problem that we were having is it's deep tech, unproven. And the world has been crying.
What does deep tech mean?
So it's at the kernel level. It's not kind of, you know, it's not surface level. There's a huge amount of R&D in it. Okay. And you know, particularly venture funds generally don't like funding R&D. They prefer to fund commercialization. And if you've got a really long R&D process ahead where you don't really know if you've thought of everything, there's always going to be unknown unknowns mm-hmm. that pop up. It just wasn't a sure enough thing. You know, they didn't like the risk component of the R&D process. But if you're to develop a really disruptive technology that is first of its kind, first in the world, never been done before, that's IP rich, you need to invest in it. It's capital intensive. We knew it would cost us about 4 million to get a product to market. And 4 million is a fruity seed raise anywhere in the world, Stephen. In Ireland, it's virtually impossible. So we knew we'd need to de-risk it with some public money. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about the public money is, you know, we applied for the Horizon Europe project or the EIC accelerator pilot, and we got 4 seals of excellence, which means extremely close, but no cigar. And we eventually got funded. Yeah, it's like, I mean, it's got a statistical success rate.
Who determines this? Like, how you can get it funded? Like,
so you put the application together, mm-hmm. and they're very, very complex beasts. But through the course of applying for those, the EIC accelerator pilot 4 times, I learned how to write a grant application. And they follow the same type of structures generally. There's 3 big sections. You get between 30 and 50 pages. There's annexes, all that kind of stuff. And the thing about those programs is they are designed to fund technologies that otherwise won't get funded. Really great ideas that otherwise investors won't invest in because it's too much of a risk component. It's risk finance, effectively. Okay. So, but the great thing about them is because the statistical success rate is so low, when you get the funding, there's a huge amount of confidence that investors can take away knowing that, for example, in these applications, you need to have a really robust risk register and risk mitigation strategy. You need to do an incredibly deep dive on your competition to prove that you've got freedom to operate, for example. And if you get a panel of evaluators, and they are tough, they're known as skilled generalists, they're European panels, and even the DTIF in Ireland, to the best of my knowledge, uses that European panel. These are experts in their fields. If they look at your application and they think themselves of a risk that you haven't noted, it's an immediate black mark. Computer says no, effectively. So these applications make you shine a light into the deepest, darkest recess of your company. All of the ugly potential things that could go wrong, and call them out and say, we've thought of that. Here's what could go wrong. And here's what we're going to do to mitigate against that risk. And if you get through that process, like the European program, the EIC Accelerator pilot, has a statistical success rate of between 1 and 4% the last time I looked. If you get through that process, your investors know, hold on, this independent panel, faceless panel, have pulled this thing apart. Then you do an interview and then you do DD, and they've done all that for us. So once you get these grant programs, investors that are in the know, smart investors know, okay, that's a really good endorsement of this product, because all these evaluators have looked into this and they've looked into all the ugliness that could go wrong, and it's been called out and they believe in it. And you have to, you know, take a deep dive and call out all of your competitors and talk about why you're different to your competitors and all that kind of thing. So the original question that you asked me was, why was nobody doing it? Yeah, it's because of the deep tech piece. Nobody had crossed the boundary before. And as I said, we were thinking we would have to decrypt. As it turned out, we didn't. You know, we developed this operating system modification at the kernel level. At that point, we can access all incoming and outgoing data, even in encrypted apps, but without the need to decrypt. You know, the UN invited us to go and showcase CHIRP at the AI for Good Summit in Geneva in July. And the organization was called the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union. It's the UN agency in charge of standards for telcos. So it's not a consumer product show. You're talking to legislators and regulators, all that kind of thing. We thought we'd need to be in the market for years before we'd get the invitation. So it was a huge boon for the company. We had a 22-minute keynote, and 7 minutes of that, I spoke about the fact that we don't decrypt. So for years, there's been this friction between law enforcement and child protection people over on one side, saying if we're to deal with the production and proliferation and dissemination of child sexual abuse material, big tech must be forced to decrypt. And then you have privacy stakeholders over this side saying, absolutely not, data sacrosanct, encryption is too important. You can't touch encryption or data for any reason, even if it's to prevent children from being sexually abused.
Wow, jeez.
And UNICEF came out a few years ago and said, look, guys, you're too far apart. This is too polarizing. You'll need to meet somewhere in the middle. We need to decrypt. Decryption is going to need to be done, but surely it can be done in a way that doesn't invade privacy or compromise privacy. And 7 minutes of that keynote, I spent talking about the fact that we don't decrypt. The information has already left the encrypted app before we access it. It's already been decrypted. It's already in plain text.
Wow.
So that's what we developed. This incredible solution that nobody thought was possible without compromising security. We've built in privacy by design. You talked a second ago about, were people concerned about, you know, the impact of CHIRP's technology on the device? And we've gone to extraordinary lengths in the last 2.5 years to make sure that we built in privacy by design, built in security by design. We couldn't be accused of being a backdoor into a device. And ethics by design, because we wanted to get to the other end of this process and be able to look back and think, we couldn't have done a better job at protecting kids and behaved in an ethical manner. You know, DCU are our partners in the DTIF consortium that I put together. And so in all of our research, for example, we've built our own small language models. You know, there's two components to our technology. There's the deep tech piece. That's the method by which we access all the incoming and outgoing data. But we have to compare that data against something. Mm-hmm. And we've built our own small language models, which are really domain specific. And they're multimodal, so text and image. And in the development of those models, we wanted to talk to kids. We wanted to get verbatim examples of cyberbullying language, of grooming language, for example, all of that. But to do that, we made sure that we went through the research ethics committee at DCU, which is a lengthy process, but we wanted to make sure that in our approach, nobody could say, oh, you spoke to children and you shouldn't have, or you asked them questions that you shouldn't have, and they gave you information that they were uncomfortable giving. We wanted to make sure that even in the building of those language models, even if, and it did constrain us a lot, you know, it really constrained us. If we had gone and done it, you know, in the, you know, move things, break fast, or break fast, move things, not to quote the devil, in that way, we would have gotten much better results much quicker from a technology perspective, but we wouldn't have been able to stand over them.
Yeah, because scrutiny, it would have been gone, it would have backfired, and then that's the headline.
Yeah.
Right. The biggest question that I have at the moment in relation to this is relating to your view on kids once you had kids, right? Did you see your kids or those in their vicinity be bullied, cyberbullied, attempt of grooming, all that stuff to spark the need for you to take on this, what I think is like, it's like a movement, right? There should not be an issue. Like, this should be happening and should be in place across the board. But people in higher places and power and all that stuff are creating boundaries and blockages. So what's your why?
It's not out of personal experience, because I started this when the kids were very, very young. It's all out of fear, if I'm honest. It's fear. It's fear that, and I take inspiration from, I'll give you an example of a guy called Andrew McCartney. He's a 26-year-old computer science grad from the North that was given a life sentence last year for the grooming of hundreds of girls. And so we work a bit with the UK Home Office. And he would pretend to, he would contact girls on public pages like Instagram or TikTok or whatever, Snapchat. And he'd target girls that were 10, 11, 12, looked like they had eating disorders. And he would contact them on those public pages, pretend to be a girl of similar age, and then start the trust cycle. So he would use phraseology like, I'm like you, we're the same, my parents didn't understand me either. And volunteer a picture of himself. So that was usually of himself. It was usually the girl that he had previously groomed naked. And that would close the trust loop. And the new girl would say, okay, she's shown me hers, I'll show her mine. And then that would be the first image. And then sending the first nude image is the tipping point in a grooming attempt, because then what he would do was use that image, which is what most groomers do, to blackmail the child for more images, videos, online grooming, you know, taking part in online grooming. And he had that process down to 9 minutes from first contact. He would bring kids into encrypted apps or where there was disappearing messages. I don't want to name check any particular apps. But he had that process down to 9 minutes. And there's a famous case of a girl, a 12-year-old girl in Florida, who killed herself, one of his victims. And then her father killed himself out of grief. And what drove her to do that was Andrew McCartney was trying to get her to involve her younger sister in the abuse. That was her tipping point.
Jesus Christ.
I use that. And then, sorry.
That's okay.
I learned. This used to kind of... It stopped causing this reaction around the time of Geneva, because I needed to train myself to be a little bit dispassionate. And I got this reaction to stop. And now I'm back. Thanks, Stephen.
You're welcome. It's good to see it, though.
Yeah.
It is good to see it, because it shows the passion that you have for the project, the potential of saving those future kids. And also tooling up parents to protect, because that's what our job is to do, is to protect our kids, right? As much as we can without invading their privacy and stuff, but also just being aware of what's going on in the world that they might be a little bit naive to.
I was invited to speak to a group of parents at a big tech company recently. And in the prep call, the two parents that were running this parents group, I was in the car and I told the story of Andrew McCartney. And then I moved on to the story of Adam Rain, the 16-year-old boy who got into a therapeutic relationship with ChatGPT and was encouraged to kill himself. And he did. And now his parents sued ChatGPT, and there's guardrails now and all that kind of stuff. And I was kind of just, you know, like a robot. I kind of have to kind of switch into the robotic mode. And then there was silence on the phone. And I realized, they were like, I'm not sure our participants are going to be able for this. I think maybe we might have to have a psychologist in the room if anybody's having difficulty or anything like that. And I was thinking, oh my God, I'm so sorry, because I'd become a bit robotic about it, because you have to. I try to focus on the positives. You know, we're raising 5 million now so that we can launch and scale. And when I'm talking to investors, I try to pick out investors that are closely aligned with us in terms of their values. You know, we've been offered money from places and where there just wouldn't be ethical alignment. And it's difficult to turn that money down. But I try and focus on, look, this is clearly going to have an amazing return on investment. From a commercial perspective, anytime I say to anybody, and they say, what do you do, Rena? And I say, we're developing child protection software for smartphones that detects and blocks cyberbullying, grooming, and suicide and self-harm. Everyone says immediately, take my money. They're all dads, moms, they have a niece, a nephew, what a grandchild, whatever. There's never any problem with product market fit. Nobody ever says, why would anybody want to buy this? Mm-hmm. So we know once we get out to market and get into the hands of the first paying customer, that is guaranteed scale. Like, I mean, it's going to go like a rocket. We've got regulatory tailwinds. The timing was terrible 8 years ago, but everybody knows somebody that's had, and it's usually like one degree of separation now, where, you know, 8 years ago, if I said the word grooming to people, they would say, and what's, half people would say, what's that? Mm. Nobody asks that question anymore. Mm. The awareness of online harms is just unbelievable. Like, it's skyrocketed. And legislators and parents, everybody's looking for this solution. But when we're talking to investors, I say, obviously, there's going to be a really clear return on investment, which is going to be great for you. However, very quickly, once we get out to market, we'll be able to measure how many cyberbullying attempts we've interrupted, how many children we've stopped being groomed, how many of those groomers we've facilitated the early detection, reporting and prosecution of, and how many lives we've saved. So I kind of like to focus on imagine the feeling of knowing that a decision that you made contributed towards a life saved, a child's life.
I think the reality of it is what you're doing is going to make a huge difference. But like in every part of facet of life, you need help. You need somebody to push you and somebody to pull you through. You've mm-hmm. obviously built a phenomenal team around you. How did you find those people? Because what's interesting is that you're turning down money for ethical reasons. So I'm sure you were building a team that had similar ethical values. How did you come across that team?
It was hard fought, I won't lie. Originally, when I started this journey, I thought, you know, once I put up on LinkedIn that we're hiring, I'll get a slew of engineers that used to work for Google or Meta, sold their soul to the devil and want to use their powers for good. We actually put together a graphic to use that included superheroes. And I was thinking, with this grand kind of animated thing, you know, this is what we'll get. We'll get these superheroes that really want to use their powers for good. That did not happen, Stephen. No. It was hard fought. You know, it took us a long time to, we brought people from all over the world. And we had delays at the start because the constraints of the Disruptive Technology Innovation Fund that we got our money from, that's taxpayers' money. So one of the constraints is that anyone you hire, you're limited in terms of the contractors you can use, very limited. And anybody that you hire has to be physically living here in Ireland, buying their coffees here, paying for their petrol here, you know. And it's all, and I get it, it's all about trying to recover some of that money by stealth for the taxpayer via PAYE and mm-hmm. VAT and all that kind of stuff. So I get it. But what that meant was we couldn't move fast and kind of get ourselves a team in Poland or, you know, Ukraine or whatever and get going on the R&D. So we were delayed. And we also, it's a very, very specific set of skills that we needed. So it's not app developers that we need, and we're drowning in applications from app developers. This is an embedded system. It's a very specific set of skills. 25, 30 years ago, you couldn't throw a stone in Detroit without hitting an embedded systems engineer, because it was kind of the start of onboard systems and all that kind of stuff. But now they're like gold dust. So, you know, our senior AOSP engineer came from BMW in Germany, for example, but he's, you know, originally from Pakistan, and we had to wait months for him because he had this long notice period and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, we ended up building an incredible team. Our CTO is an unusual beast, Mark, in that he has started two companies and sold one. So he's a CTO. He's got experience all the way from application layer to architecture and infrastructure. But he understands entrepreneurship, and he's an entrepreneur himself. You know, he's not coming from, and we had a couple of experiences where we took these senior engineers from big tech, and they were like, "And where's my team to do this?" And it's like, no, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
You're the team. You're the hands-on. You're that guy that codes. So we got this really amazing scrappy guy, Mark, and he's brilliant at managing the team and putting them together. Great at spotting skill. We couldn't afford experience. So what we ended up doing was leveraging programs like the FIT program and stuff like that. And we traded experience for excellence.
Okay.
And that's what Mark does. He can spot someone really excellent with amazing potential, but doesn't have the skills yet, but he knows.
Can guide them.
They're there. Okay. They're an applied mathematician that can be converted and that kind of stuff. So, and then our head of AI, Zhang, wrote the algorithm for the hate track tool, which was developed to detect racially motivated hate speech on Twitter. So we've got, like, our head of AI has direct experience of this, you know, coming out of his last jobs. And then you've got Mark. So between them, the two teams are just extraordinary.
Tell me, I know when we first met, you were able to show me how everything worked, right? And in your best ability now, with people listening.
Yeah.
Could you explain how it works from, obviously, that there's, when this goes to market, from my understanding, there'll be mobile phones or smartphones with the Chirp logo on them, which means that has the technology inside in the product. And parents will buy that product for the kids. In the same breath, the parents will have access to will be able to see or understand if anything comes through to that kid's phone that's inappropriate, they'll get a notification. And it's not as simple as the kid going in and breaking the code and turning off the passcode like you would with other apps. Because this is embedded in it, they don't get access to it, but the parents will be able to see what's going on, be notified, and then they can go and intercept it and figure it out what the next steps are. Is that essentially it?
If I was to walk in front of a bus tomorrow, Stephen, you can step in as CEO because, like, you've done a great job there. So the user journey, just to kind of articulate it for parents, is you'll walk into a Vodafone or a Three or an Air store, and you'll say, "I want a truly safe smartphone for my child," and they'll say, "Here, have this Chirp-enabled Samsung A52," and you bring it home. It's just a normal phone. But Chirp is in settings. The default is off. So if you're an adult, you just use that phone. It's not on. Or you can go into settings. You can go into Chirp and you can switch it on. At that point, you're given a QR code. And you take your phone, doesn't matter what sort of phone you have, and it brings you to the app store. You download a parent app to your own device. Then you enter the date of birth of your child, password, protect it, link it to your email address, and click apply. And that remotely sets up Chirp on your child's device. It can't be disabled on the child's device, which means it's tamper-proof and it's part of settings, so it can't be deleted by a tech-savvy teen. And then you have your dashboard. So that app it's called a provisioning app. That's where you get your notifications. So we'll send you, we've intercepted, you know, an inappropriate image. This is the person your child was trying to send it to. So in practice, what that means is if we detect your child as being cyberbullied on WhatsApp, we block the message. We tell the child we block the message and we save it in a locked file on the child's phone and we send you an alert. It's all done in real time with no lag. We went to extraordinary lengths in our R&D process to make sure that this was all done with no noticeable latency, because otherwise you'll get the child would just reject the whole thing. And just to reverse a little bit as well, at onboarding, the child has to agree. We ask for the explicit agreement of the child, not a consent thing, because under GDPR, parents can consent on behalf of their child. But we want to bring the kids on the journey with us. All the research suggests that if you spy on your child, you'll just push them into secret internet use. And then they'll just go and buy burner phones and you'll have no visibility at all. So we're trying to create this process where parents and kids work together for online safety, but crucially where kids feel like their voice is heard. They've got some agency, they've got some independence. And we don't. So for that reason, we've made some decisions. We don't send the information off the phone to you, the parent. We send you the notification and we say, go to the phone with your child, have a look at this message, see what it says. And then there's a feedback loop. So if we got it wrong, tell us we got it wrong, we overreacted. If we got it right, great. That validates that that is a cyberbullying event. But we also give you information on how to deal with that event with your child, you know, communication strategies, that kind of thing. Or if we detect that your child opens up a camera in Snapchat, for example, and tries to send a nude image of themselves, we detect it's a nude image and we delete it. And we send you an alert and we say your child was trying to send a picture of themselves to this person. And that gives you the opportunity. Now, the reason we delete the image, we could keep the image, but we've made the decision not to, because we want to do no harm. So we've done all these workshops with our partners, the Anti-Bullying Research Centre at DCU, to figure out what our notification framework would look like. So what we didn't want to do was, if you imagine you're an 11-year-old child and you go to take a nude image of yourself, and we say, you're not allowed to send that. We've saved that and we've sent your parent a message and they're coming to look at it. Mm-hmm. And what's that going to do? That could cause a catastrophic event. Mm-hmm. So we didn't want to do any harm. So we made some technical decisions on that basis. But what we do is we say, your child, Mary, was going to send Paul an intimate image or an inappropriate image. Go and have a chat with your child about this contact, see who they were. If it was a grooming event, there's a red button. You can collect all of the communication with Paul and you can present that to the guards. Or if it's two 13-year-olds in a consenting sexual relationship and they're just expressing, you know, the usual, it's a good segue for you to be able to talk to your child about the permanency of sending a nude image out into the internet. You know, you trust this person now, but what about in 5 hours? What about in 5 days, 5 years? And they've still got this image of you. So it's still kind of, it fosters that collaborative approach. It improves communication around smartphone use. We're trying to reduce familial friction around smartphone use. Mm-hmm. Because what's happening at the moment is most parents are, via pester power, pushed into giving kids smartphones sooner than they really are comfortable with. And usually the process is, you know, yes, oh, fine, we'll give you a phone. You can have it for an hour a day, never in the bedroom. And anytime I want, the rule is I can pick up your phone and I can look at it. And kids will say mass to get their first phone. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, within a week, it's like, but all my friends have the phone all day. And then you go, okay, fine, you can have your phone all day. And then the following week, it's, but my friends can have their phone in their bedroom. Why can't I? Why do you hate me? And then all of a sudden, the phone is in the bedroom. And then all of a sudden, why do you not trust me? Why are you taking my phone off me? So we're trying to reduce that familial friction so kids can have reasonably unfettered access to their device and they feel like they are in control of their own online safety. Kids don't want to be harmed. Mm-hmm. And this is why, like, there's social media bans happening all over the world. Like, I think it was started by Australia, where kids under 16 aren't allowed to have social media. As a parent, I'm in two minds about it. You know, my daughter came up to me a couple of months ago and said, Dad said we could, she was 8 at the time. Dad said we could talk about me getting Snapchat. And I just started roaring. Now, I feel sorry for my kids, Stephen, because I know too much.
Okay.
And so I started roaring at Fergal. And he was like, oh, she came at me in the kitchen. I was busy. I was making the dinner. And she, you know, this is what kids do. They look for the weak points and they exploit.
Ask your mother.
So on the social media side, I'm extremely against my own children having social media because of its addictive properties, other things like, or I think it was Amnesty International did an assessment of TikTok in May. And they set up child accounts, like teenage accounts, and they just left them. They didn't like anything. They didn't hover on anything. They just left them. And within 3 to 6 hours, more than 50% of the feed being served to these kids was related to suicide, self-harm, or romanticizing very, very dangerous behaviors. Oh, wow. That's without doing anything. Wow. So this is what's being served to kids on social media. Sorry, I digress back into my stories again. But I'm against social media for my own kids personally. But the jury is out on this these moves all over the world to stop kids getting access to social media until they're 16. Because it feeds into that, if you prohibit something, you make it more attractive. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants something that's prohibited. And you are ultimately pushing kids into secret internet use. So, and they'll be afraid to tell you then, oh, I can't, a 13-year-old that's bought a burner phone and is on TikTok and sees, I don't know, a cat getting blended, you know, they won't communicate that to you and tell you that it's upset them and give you the opportunity to help them through these feelings, because they'll be thinking, my parent doesn't know about this burner phone and doesn't know that I'm on social media and it's illegal. So yeah. You create a barrier. So the jury is out.
There's the education part of it all, isn't it? And like when they walk away from school, I'm not sure even if in the curriculum, if there's any specific module about teaching kids how to manage social media and how to act online and what that's going to look like in the future. And maybe there's something on the education side of things that needs to happen so that kids, when they do put something out there, that they're proud of it, as opposed to being in fear that somebody's going to see it or that somebody's going to share it. Because I'm sure in time, your social currency, whatever you do online, will impact future mortgages, future loans, you know, all these different things. Mm. But do you, from your own experience, when we talk about we were talking about images there, the system intercepts language as well, right? So how does it determine what's okay and what's not? Because if somebody is saying something in jest, it'd be a bit weird if they were doing something like that. But, you know, in the different tones, the way kids communicate, now there's all, like my goddaughter, they're talking about Riz, and I'm like, what the hell does that mean? You know, and I haven't a clue.
Get with the program, Grandad.
You know, we're having a clue. Like, and my son is going to grow up with that whole world and the next one. But like, how do you intercept it in a way that's actually preventing the harm and not just preventing
Yeah, and so you know when I do the demo for you, and I always use we've built our net nudity detection model on adult nude imagery because it's not legal for us to collect child nude imagery. But we're working with an organisation called the Internet Watch Foundation in the UK. They have hashed data sets of child sexual abuse material to make sure, and they'll test, train, and validate our data set against theirs to make sure we catch child nude imagery. But there are levels. You can set levels in terms of your detection sensitivity, if you like. So for demonstration purposes, the chirp device that I bring around with me in my handbag that's battered and bruised at the moment, when I'm showing you that demo, I usually pull up a picture on Google of a woman in a micro bikini. And I show you that if a child opens a camera in Snapchat or TikTok or WhatsApp, that calls it like any app your child is in, if they call the camera, that app doesn't have its own camera. It calls the camera that's on the device. So we have a camera intercept. And we've patented and all that kind of stuff. So I can show you live that if with a chirp-enabled device, I try and take a picture with the camera from any app, it will, a woman in a micro bikini will trigger the nudity detection and it'll delete that image. It'll detect and delete it and send the alert directly to the parent's phone. You can raise that bar up and down. So for demonstration purposes, so that I don't have to sit in front of you. Or in one case, one of our investors is in his 70s. It was a very awkward demonstration to have to do so that I don't have to make him look at me taking a picture of a fully naked woman. You can set that bar. Mm-hmm. And that's what we'll ultimately do. You know, we've developed these lightweight models that sit on the device for a variety of reasons where we catch what you would consider the low hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if your child goes into a browser like Google or onto a large language model like ChatGPT and looks for ways to harm themselves, you know, girls will look for things like cutting, burning, extreme dieting, proanapromia, which is anorexia and bulimia. Boys often will look for much more violent stuff. How do I kill myself? How do I hang myself? That kind of thing. If we, like, they're very obvious search key phrases, kill, hang, suicide, self-harm, extreme dieting, they could be dictionaries. So we have these lightweight language models that sit on the device. And that's principally to maintain battery power, make sure there's no impact on the battery, reduce the cost of compute, and make sure there's no latency. So we catch that low-hanging fruit. There's not much kind of, like, real analysis that needs to be done there. It's quite binary. If a child looks on Google for how do I hang myself, we catch it, stop it, and send you an immediate alert in real time. This is urgent. You need to do something about this. And if the child goes frenetically searching, you know, gets frustrated that we're redirecting them to a support page and they go to different browsers or different language models and search for the same thing out of frustration in a short period of time, we can notify you that there's real intensity in this intent here. You know, this child really, really wants to find this information. You need to act very, very quickly. The reason I'm telling you this is because on the language processing, you can catch that low-hanging fruit really quite easily. If you take the cyberbullying, for example, if someone says, you should go and kill yourself, or, you know, you fat bitch or something like that, that's, you know, it's likely, highly likely that that's not a joke, you know? Whereas other conversations are much more nuanced, for example, and we've developed a conversation state history analysis model, which is done in the cloud, takes a little bit longer, but it means that if we detect you should go and kill yourself, or what were you even wearing today, which is much more subtle, we would look at that and say there's negative sentiment here. Let's look back at the conversation string and we can go back and try and figure out the sentiment so that we can try and detect, is this just a joke, or in the last 8 sentences in this conversation string, is there negativity creeping in? This is the crescendo, in which case we would then trigger a cyberbullying event.
Okay.
And block a message. Child knows, parent gets notified, parent gets an opportunity to deal with it.
Wow. Fascinating. Like, what do you see the next couple of years looking like for Chirp?
Planes, trains, and automobiles.
yeah, because you're everywhere at the moment, aren't you?
Yeah.
Do you, yeah, like at the top of the show, we were talking and you've put a hell of an amount of time and sacrifice into this. So much so now that you're so close, I think, on getting a breakthrough that it's head down, keep pedaling now for the next while. So could you give people just a sense of what that challenge has been like since you decided to go after this business and decided to bring this to life? Like, how have you been over the last number of years? Like, have you seen yourself change? And if so, in what way?
Oh, Stephen. Yes, I have changed. We're much closer to hero now. Much closer. We're within touching distance. You know, we're a couple of months out from market. We are under LOI. We're under NDA with some of the world's biggest telcos, telco groups, tier one telco groups. Arguably the biggest handset manufacturer has been in touch with us from two distinct and separate business units over the last month looking for a partnership proposal. Things are looking extremely, extremely good. I guess I'm impatient now. Now that we're at this point, I had 2 years of CEOing. It was delightful. Just running the company, getting out there, going into all these big telcos, doing the demo, talking about where we will be at the end of 2025 and, you know, gearing up for launch in 2026. And it was wonderful. Like the best use of my time is being on planes, trains and automobiles and going in, doing jazz hands, doing the demo and saying, look at this amazing technology. And everyone loves it. I thought that after we got the last raise in the seed raise, the 4.4 million that we got. So we got 2.8 million euro non-dilutive grant from the DTIF and then we had to co-fund that. We ended up oversubscribed in the end, which was great. But I thought that was the hard yard. But things haven't really improved on the funding front. Now, we've got an amazing strategic lead who are, you know, they're quite shy, I don't want to be mentioned. And then we've also got Evan Sharp, who is the co-founder of Pinterest, is investing in this round. We've got a bunch of other kind of big names coming into the round. But it's been hard fought, you know, even though we're at this crucial point where we are touching distance from getting out to market. And it's going to be an amazing product. And like, I'm very, very excited for 2026. So we decided basically at this stage that it made an awful lot of sense to get bring a small amount of the raise in through crowdfunding. So crowdfunding, it's interesting and strategic for a couple of reasons. Obviously, you get capital into the company, which is brilliant, contributes towards the raise. But we're targeting the UK very aggressively for the first place that hopefully we'll achieve standard. We've always developed Chirp to be the international standard because there is none. And it was great that we got the invite by the ITU, the UN agency, over to Geneva and all that. Now, we feel like we have really good, strong regulatory tailwinds. Government agencies really like us. Regulators really like us because we fill the void that's left by the legislation that's out there. So the legislation generally doesn't cover encrypted apps. And that's our USP. So we cover non-encrypted apps. But the big, you know, thing that we kind of broadcast is that we can extract harmful content from encrypted apps without decryption. So we're targeting the UK very aggressively. So we were like, look, let's bring a small amount in through crowdfunding. We'll choose a UK-based in the main crowdfunding platform. And you bring in all these kind of smaller retail investors that become your evangelists. So, you know, these investors might invest 10 euro or they might invest half a million. But they then, once you are at market, they go to their dinner party on a Saturday night and they say, wait until I show you what I've invested in. Mm-hmm. And you know this from sitting at dinner parties, Stephen, like, it's rare that child protection in some way doesn't come up, whether it's, you know, oh my God, are you having this terrible problem with, you know, grow a garden on Roblox and my son is doing this, or, you know, there was like, you know, some awful material reached my kid's WhatsApp group. You know, what are we going to do about this? Happens all the time. And so we were like, it makes an awful lot of sense to bring in loads of these tiny little small retail investors, give them a sense of pride and Chirp, let them become a part of online protection. These are people that generally kind of would feel locked out of investment. You know, they don't gamble on stocks and all that kind of stuff. And they feel like it's not for them. So, and also it gives you market validation. So our customers, we can send that on to our customers and we can say, you know, these are all the people that we managed to get to invest. And the more, the merrier, you know, more investors, smaller quantums.
So, and I love how you did that, right? Like the crowdfunding is going to be really impressive, right? And it's going to give you a micro or guerrilla marketing approach to all these investors from all around the place. But my question to you was, how has it changed you? So like, if you look back from when you began to who you are now, what would you say are the kind of the key things that you've maintained and things that you've kind of... characteristics that have come on board that you didn't think were there initially?
You're not letting me away with this.
No.
I thought I got away with that one. I'd make a good politician.
So you've been in this world too long.
You do the politician thing. I like your question, but I'll answer this other one
that I prefer to talk about. And like, listen, be brief. Listen, I know there's a lot. There's a lot. And it's been 8 years, right? So there's a lot of...
Yeah. I'm happy to talk about it. I've become much more relentless.
Okay.
And I take heart from, you know, you see these posts on LinkedIn sometimes where founders will say, you know, I just sold my company for X, but, you know, in order to get that last raise in before I did my big exit, I spoke to 400 investors. So I kind of remind myself of that kind of stuff. I've become much better at looking after kind of... So I've become much more relentless and I've realized that I need to be relentless in order to make this happen. I've become more tenacious, probably less confident.
Interesting.
There's one thing I was never lacking was confidence, and that was because of my parents. My parents did a great job of telling me that I could achieve anything. There's always a way. And I firmly believe there is always a way. But I'd say 8 years ago when I started the journey and people were like, oh my God, a female founder of a tech company, everyone's going to be throwing money at you. People are going to absolutely love this. And I was like, yeah, they will. And then it did not happen. Because I came from a media background and media, as you know, is 50-50. You know, I remember very arrogantly when I was 20, to give you an example, I remember going in and doing an interview in 98 FM and the CEO at the time said, where will you be in 5 years or 10 years? And I said, I don't know, but in 5 years, I'll be in your seat. It took me 10, but I got there because really being a woman wasn't a barrier. It wasn't a barrier to becoming a CEO. And I was delightfully, you know, I was quite oblivious. I was living in this kind of equal world. And I was just uber confident. And then I suppose over the last 8 years, I've realized that confidence isn't everything. Mm-hmm. You know, fake it till you make it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. You know, it's hard work. Learning how to write grant applications. It's, you know, teaching yourself about technology. It's doing all of the hard stuff instead of letting confidence help you bluff your way through. So I think I've become less confident, but I've become less reliant on my confidence. I kind of back it up a little bit more now.
Yeah, I was going to say that, like, the confidence that you had initially was more of a front that you could make it because, sure, it's me and it'll be fine and we'll get through it. Whereas now you're backing it all on figures.
You know, it wasn't a front. I believed it. I believed it. I was like, I can do anything.
Yeah.
And I was shocked when I was confronted with this reality that, no, it goes... It requires much, much more effort.
Interesting.
And so, you might lose.
Yeah,
I had never contemplated losing.
Okay, how does that sit with you?
It's humbling. I'm a more thoughtful person now. It used to be all about kind of visualizing greatness and all that kind of stuff. And there's still a component of that to me. Like I'll think about kind of goals in the future and that kind of stuff. But it's done more in a strategic kind of way. Mm. It's all about achieving strategic goals rather than, you know, imagining greatness mm-hmm. for me and the company. I've become much more cognizant as well. Like IBEC released a thing, a founder's thing, this morning. It's in the Irish Times. And it was a survey of Irish founders. And it talked about mental health being a key concern. And I was really kind of proud of that. I was kind of looking at it going, my God, all the people that took part in that survey were really honest about the challenges of, you know... To be fair, like Fergal, my husband, has a line on the cap table and, you know, he owns about the same amount of the company as I do. That's because he believed in the company enough to let me drain our savings.
Yeah.
I literally bet the whole thing on this. And that has caused an awful lot of stress because in those moments where you feel like, oh, Christ, are we going to make it? Now, I know deep down we will. I know this is an amazing product. And if there was, like, the doubts are almost completely gone now because we're out the gap technology speaking. We've got all the timing is perfect. But up until kind of, you know, a few months ago, you know, it's difficult not to kind of let that, the weight of that responsibility that you have to your family, because ultimately your family are the ones that make the sacrifices if you're a founder. So when you think about the fact that you haven't bought a bigger house and you kind of think about all the money that you spent on the startup and at the sacrifice of having the bigger house for the kids and all that kind of stuff, it's difficult not to let that kind of rattle you and sit as a kind of a permanent kind of feeling. But so I'm more considered now about, I'm very rigid about exercise. I'm very rigid about sleep hygiene, those types of things, because I know that's really, really important as an entrepreneur because of that kind of like roller coaster.
Yeah, you can't try and be everything to all people. You have to protect yourself in a way, and in doing that through exercise and sleep, you have that rigidness. I do think though, I can resonate to a point where you're looking at that responsibility. It's kind of like a spark that's kind of constantly igniting, especially if there's maybe moments where you're like uncertain, I presume. Mm-hmm. what I learned when I was setting my business and speaking to entrepreneurs and stuff was very much just to continue to back yourself, because nobody backs you more than yourself, mm-hmm. right? And it's sometimes hard because we all go through those peaks and troughs of what ifs, am I good enough? Self-talk could be a bit out the window some days. And we mightn't be able to share with family because we feel that we might burden family, right? So there's that kind of...
There's a lot of that.
There's a kind of like this virtuous circle of, well, if I say that, then they're going to think this and then they won't be happy and then I can't say that. And you become kind of protected. You try and protect yourself, mm-hmm. but in doing so, protect others. And that can have such a negative connotation then in the long run, because then you explode eventually because you can't hold it in. And then you explode and then it's, well, we didn't know, why didn't you talk? Do you find it easy to talk and to share? Because I find it very, very difficult sometimes, especially as somebody I'm a big believer of asking for help, but I find it very hard to do that personally, whereas I'm a big advocate of my friends doing it. So I have to take that kind of leap and that bit of bravery or courage to do it and allow myself to be vulnerable in that moment. I find that very, very uncomfortable, but I find it really rewarding after the fact. It's like a cry, you know? Sometimes you have a cry and you're like, okay, right, I just needed that.
Yeah.
How do you find that? Is that a challenge for you?
No, there's two parts. So I would probably make about 100 decisions in a day.
Yeah.
And I do, because of the volume, you tend to do it mostly in your head. You don't verbalize it. You don't need input. You know what just let me have the think, let me make the decision and that's it. That, like, for example, my husband Fergal would be saying to me, you know, let share the burden. And I'm like, no, it's more burdensome and more, it'll take longer for me to make these decisions if I bring other people into it. So a lot of the time, people don't really understand this about me. I'm quiet because I'm processing decisions a lot of the time. When it comes to difficulties, I rely quite heavily on my startup friends and other CEOs, other entrepreneurs. You know, I've got a really great network from the Software CEO Forum, and we bounce ideas off each other. If I'm, you know, and we can be quite honest and say, look, I had a bad board meeting or, you know, personal stuff, but business stuff, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And that's really comforting to talk to somebody that has been in exactly your position, knows exactly how you feel, and knows that the loved ones and friends in your life don't really understand.
Mm-hmm.
Being a CEO is lonely a lot of the time. So it's very important to have that network of other CEOs that you can rely on, not just for solving problems, but just to know that they've been there and you're not alone, you're not weak, you know, this is just a moment in time. It's just, it'll pass.
It's funny you say that, because there's a nice quote that's quite a bit in the different episodes I've done, and it always brings me back to Carl Rogers, who's a philosopher, and his point is what's most personal is most universal. And I think if you apply that to your world and CEO, that when you speak to people in that world, they can relate to your challenge. And by sharing it, then you have a way or halfway to the solution. Similarly, in family life and in friendships, people going through anxiety or stress or worry or heartbreak or whatever, when you share your experience, like when we went through a fairly difficult time in 2023, and I'll never forget it. I was with 5 or 6 of my mates, and it would be a kind of like a taboo subject to talk about miscarriages and the challenge of that. And I said it to 5 or 6 of the guys at the time. They said, why aren't you staying? I said, this is what happened to us. And they all said, well, of the 6 guys, 5 of them had been through it. And by me sharing that as a lad, it gave them the freedom to talk about it, which they'd never shared with anybody. So I think what you're doing and the way you're approaching that is very normal, you know? So it's, And it's good that you're getting that response from your peers, because what you're doing is right. It's just part of the process.
Yeah. I mean, look, like you say, it's rare. If I'm to talk about a particular difficulty I'm having with my company or in my professional life, it's rare that I reach out to the other CEOs in my life that they haven't experienced
yeah.
it. They'll have something to offer. And if they don't have anything to offer because they haven't experienced it, it's just someone that understands and you can kind of let it out.
Mm-hmm.
And like you say, just the saying of it out loud
yeah.
releases you from
it. Does. It's better out than in, as they say.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this question, because I think it's something that I love asking people, and I try, it kind of puts them on the spot a little bit to think outside or think differently. So the work that you're doing and the life that you've lived and the way you've kind of approached things, right? You're gone in the morning, right? But you have a message that goes up onto a billboard that it allows you, and we know at billboards, you get 3 seconds to pass by, and that message is something that you'll leave behind to your kids, to your family, to your peers, to whoever it is. If you were to leave a message, what would that be?
Hello, how many words do I have?
You have 3 seconds.
There's always a way.
Okay. Why would that, what does that say to you?
That no matter what struggles you have or what you want to achieve in life, there's always a way to get through the struggle or to achieve what you want to achieve. So say, for example, I was having this conversation yesterday. When I was in school, the career guidance counselor told me I'd make a really great secretary. And I was like, well, I kind of want to, at that time, I was convinced I wanted to be an architect. So I was like, no, I want to build buildings. And then I changed my mind, and then I changed my mind again. So my daughter is 9, and I'd really like for her to, when she gets to graduating and she's thinking about what she wants to do in college, I'd really like for entrepreneurship to be a natural thing, just like being a teacher, just like considering going into the law or being a doctor or a nurse. I'd like for her to think that entrepreneurship is something that she could achieve. An awful lot of, like, I was lucky, as I said, my parents gave me an awful lot of confidence. So when I did decide to open my own business, it didn't occur to me in any tiny way, shape or form that I couldn't do it. Because I always thought there's always a way. So that's what I kind of try and stick to, is there's always a way. Getting back to my daughter, I would like for her to think, I'd like to pass that on to her. I'd like to pass it on to my son. I'd like to impart it to all of the other founders out there that are having a bad day or whatever. Just in this moment, think to yourself, whatever the challenge is, whatever the goal is, there's always a way.
I love that. There is always a way, and I think you are proving that point as well. You're so close to bringing Chirp to play, and I think if people wanted to know more, to invest.
go to my LinkedIn.
Yeah. But if people wanted to reach out to learn more, to get a sense of this and be part of essentially the right side of history, to be able to protect kids in the future across the globe, no matter, like, I could see this going into war-torn countries and being able to use it in other ways. Mm. I'm sure the technology would be adaptable in so many other ways to protect kids. How could they reach out to you? And yeah.
Yeah. So contact me on rena@chirpfamily.com or rena@chirpfamily.com. Like, look, no matter, you know, when you're talking about investment, if you want to invest, I firmly believe that anybody that wants to invest in Chirp should have access to me at a point. I don't want to be, you know, diverting people over to an info at and all that kind of stuff. Or if anybody thinks that they have a contact in a telco that would, you know, be interesting for us to talk to, or in a handset manufacturer, or any of those things, mm-hmm. or has a contact in a regulator somewhere in the world, just reach out. We will take all of the contacts.
Love it. I do think, as a person, first and foremost, when I first met you, I was blown away by just your approach and happiness and welcome. I was on my own in an event. I said hello to yourself and Ferg, and next thing we're here, right? So I was blown away by your presence. But as a CEO, I'm blown away by your determination and your tenacity and your just can-do attitude and that your belief in yourself and the rest of the team and the product that you've created. I think we might have to create a CEO series or something and get you back when the seed is done. But I think you're a fantastic person. I think what you've done is and what you're doing is phenomenal. I really hope that people who've listened to this can get a sense of your passion, can take inspiration from you growing in from a world of 50-50 into a male dominant world and still soaring. And I think it's a testament to you, to your folks and to the people you have around you. So thank you so much for taking the part.
You've made my day. That was a lovely compliment. You're very kind.
Thanks a million, Rena.
Thank you.